This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
That's why working with someone like Dita Von Teese, you know, when she gives us a costume to do, it's just a treat for us because it's like, first of all, instead of keeping the dress on, we've got to find a way of it coming off. You know, we quite often have projects like that, and I think it brings a lot of creativity into the studio.
In this series of podcasts, I talk to people at the forefront of the creative industries about their life and work and their relationship to luxury. Today, my guest is a womenswear designer who, in her 30-year-plus career, has become a favourite of so many stars, it's difficult to know where to start. From the Duchess of Cambridge to Miley Cyrus, from Dita Von Teese to Helen Mirren, from Beyoncé to Keira Knightley. You'll have seen her work during countless Oscar ceremonies, in Harry Potter films, Bond films, in Sex and the City, and The Devil Wears Prada. Welcome, Jenny. I hope you managed to find your way through the rather packed Harrods today. I've got a slight sense it might be something to do with the heat wave and the draconian air conditioning in here.
Well, it's so hot outside today. I think everybody's just dashing in.
Exactly. I'm delighted to be here in the cool and calm. I wanted to talk to you, first of all, about your sort of early days at St. Martin's. Mm-hmm. Did you have a sense then that you wanted to be a fashion designer? Because I think it's something you discovered as a child was a career potential and sort of went for it.
I think I really realised that it was a job when I was about 11. I had a brother who was very brilliant at everything, and I think I had to come up with something that he could back off on and let me have my space.
It does sound like your brother took up a lot of airspace. He's the naturalist, Chris Packham, also mm-hmm. a bit of a campaigner. And I think you didn't start talking till you were 3 years old. Is that true?
Well, he used to talk a lot. I mean, he still does. So, yeah, I mean, for me, he was the most wondrous brother. I mean, I couldn't ask for a better one. I mean, my complete hero. And, you know, the whole household sort of world around him and all of his sort of, you know, interests and ambitions. But I think, you know, it really helped to have that sort of energy. I mean, the house was sort of bursting with sort of creativity because Chris is also very creative, and my mum and dad pandered to anything that we were interested in. So, you know, it was really lively. And
but did you do things like open the fridge and find, you know, dead crows in there?
Oh, I have so many stories. I mean, I came home from school once and there was a snake coming down the stairs. My mum used to say, go and get the fish cakes, and I'd find those dead animals in the freezer. And it was always changing. There was always sort of new animals, and people would bring things round once they got to know that he was, you know, interested. So, you know, it was quite a small house in Southampton, but it was like a sort of little mini zoo, really. But I think I was very lucky. Both of my grandmothers were, one of them was a dressmaker for the sort of area. The other one was very much into sort of needlework. It felt very natural that you had to kind of make things and produce things. So Chris was the punk rocker. So obviously, you know, I wasn't going to touch his territory. And I was 4 years younger. So for me, I became a mod, you know, when they had their, you know, the
revival.
Yeah. And that was fantastic because it made me sort of go all over Hampshire looking for little vintage shops, trying to get that Winkle Picker and that coat and everything. So it was really, you know, that was a great sort of little journey for me. And it was very harmless being a mod, actually, whereas I just couldn't step up to being a punk.
I'm surprised animal skins didn't feature in more of your collections. You would have had so many readily at hand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Chris and I have worked together on lots of things throughout the years. I mean, I've used some of his photography to do prints on dresses. I made all the shirts for him for the Really Wild show when he first started.
That's sisterly love.
Yeah, we although sort of our worlds are very different, you know, we do kind of really use each other a lot as a sort of, you know, soundboard.
Now, you were at St. Martin's, would have been in the 80s?
1987. 84 to 87.
I was reading somewhere that at the end of the course, or, you know, at some point in the course, people who wanted to start their own company were asked to raise their hands, and you were in a very small minority who
did. Yeah, there was two of us. I was really quite taken aback because I just always had it in my head that I would have my own label. And I just thought that was everybody's dream.
So who would have been the people who you sort of admired and felt could follow in the footsteps of at that point?
Well, at that time, I mean, St. Martin's was such a lively place. I mean, we had people coming in from directors, you know, just dropping in saying, you know, can you design some costumes for us? I seemed to earn a fortune when I was a student, actually, but that was the 80s. I mean, I went to see some of my first fashion shows would have been sort of Sandra Rhodes and Jasper Conran and that sort of group. I mean, I think Sandra Rhodes is one of the best designers we've ever had, incredible. So I think I was very inspired by her sort of, you know, the beautiful textiles she did and the fact that she was creating the whole garment, you know, which is something that I've always wanted to do, is not just sort of buy some fabric and make something out of it. It's actually take the whole process and cover it, my creativity, really, like get it beaded or printed or do something to it.
But having your own fashion house at that time, I guess, wasn't really as common as it is today in terms of, you know, there's lots of people who sort of think, I'm going to start up and I'm going to...
I think it felt, actually, at the time, it was that sort of, dare I say it, that sort of Thatcherism, which was, you know, if you want to do it, have a go. We were working in Portobello at the time, and there was a lot of sort of business support stuff going on. I think the trouble, like a lot of fashion companies, is you get a lot of help in the beginning, even sort of financial help. And we had Prince's Trust and various different grants. And then you get to a point where you get some production, and then you really need to fund it. And I think that's when everything becomes very difficult.
And did you have a sense right from the start of the kind of designer you were going to be? Because it does sound like you had quite a kind of fully fleshed out notion of what you wanted to do.
I really try and think about why it is that I've always been interested in special occasion, you know, the bridal, the evening wear, things that people are going to go to, something that they will remember, kind of markers in their life. And I think really it is because I like being involved in that, to create something that someone is going to cover and look after and that they're going to remember. That makes it viable to me, as opposed to doing something that someone's just going to wear and chuck away at some point.
But you're also dealing with people at the height of their emotions, aren't you? You know,
yeah.
If you're dealing with people at those different points, and that, then there are good things
and also
bad
they're going to pay
that.
More for it. So you as a designer, you get more scope, you know, you can do more to it. You can buy more beautiful fabrics. You can have it hand beaded. So it gives you a lot of sort of possibilities.
But do you have to be a bit of a psychologist as well? Because, you know, you're dealing with people who will be feeling vulnerable about the things that they're vulnerable about, and perhaps will have differing ideas about what their best features and worst features might be. Do you know what I mean? There are all those things playing into it, plus just the immense pressure of, if it's a wedding, I mean, you know, the day and the thing. And if it's a big occasion, you know, got to look better than, I don't know, Kate Blanchett. You know, she's going to be walking down right behind. You know, there's that sense of everything being heightened.
I think the more information I know about, I mean, if I'm lucky enough to actually work with someone, you know, in a sort of one-to-one way, the more information I have about where they're going and what they wore before, and, you know, like we do with the red carpet, you look at what everyone's worn. There's no point designing them another red dress if they had a wow one, you know, last season. So you definitely want to know. And if you come away from celebrities, you know, women just going to a wedding or doing something, I think to get a sense of what they're, you know, what they're trying to achieve. But generally, I would say that I want to empower women in a sort of way that they can feel very confident in what they're doing and enjoy themselves without actually having to think too much about what they're wearing.
People look amazing when they get dressed up for a big event or a red carpet event or just a ball or, you know, all of the many things that women will come to you to get dresses for or clothes for. And normally they look magnificent, but what do you think are the biggest mistakes people make?
I think mostly they're accessorizing. For me, I think if you're wearing a dress that's covered in sequins or it's got an amazing cut or something, then, you know, just leave it. You know, I think that's sometimes what I see is, you know, people go out and they buy themselves the dress and maybe they don't want to buy the shoes and the bag and everything. So then they wear something that they've already got sometimes. So I think rather than think about just the dress, think about the whole outfit. And if you have to take the budget and share it around a bit, make sure it all sort of works together, because you can blow it with just the wrong accessorizing, really.
I was going to ask whether you had a particular style in terms of what you wanted to make. Because when I think of you, I think you just make beautiful things that highlight the best of women's shapes and disguise the worst of them, which is what we're all looking for. And that's the best of fashion. That's being able to be the best you can be. But it's quite at odds with a lot of the fashion world, in inverted commas.
I think when people, either when they're getting married or when if they're going out for a special occasion, a lot of women have this sense of wanting to be slightly timeless with it, because I think they will have images. They don't take so many risks because those images are going to be around for a long time. I mean, it isn't real. I mean, I think you can choose your wedding dress and think that you're choosing a timeless dress, but in 10, 20 years' time, it is going to look from that era. However, I don't muck around too much with the shape. I think I'm quite classic with the shape. But within that, I really sort of experiment with the textures.
Yeah, I went to the Dior exhibition at the V&A yesterday, and I was really struck by the fact that some of the dresses that were being made when Christian Dior was still alive, those shapes were being repeated over and over again down the decades, you know. And there were bursts of kind of Galliano's madness and whatever. But actually, the shapes were classic and remained similar over the course of many decades.
I think ultimately, if you look back in, you know, in history, the most favoured silhouette hasn't changed that much. You know, most women wear those silhouettes. I mean, if you haven't got, you know, much of a shoulder, you wear a little bit of a shoulder pad. I mean, they're just very simple techniques that we all use, and they've always been around, really.
You know, my daughter was just completely overtaken with the tiny waists and the big skirts, you know, which are not sort of fashionable just now, but every woman I think I know wants to feel like that at some point.
Yeah, and they do with their wedding. I mean, that's very much coming back into fashion again in the bridal area. We've had this real sort of boho thing for quite a while now. And they say sometimes when things get a bit tougher politically or economically, women go back to that almost restricted kind of corseted feel.
Really? And is that something that you've observed?
Brighter lipsticks, sometimes shorter skirts. I don't know whether it's a sense of security, but it's also because those dresses are viewed as expensive and big and different. And I think when times are better, people get a little bit more casual.
You started up your business immediately on leaving St. Martin's with your husband, who was a sculptor. And I wondered if that was a skill set that came in very handy, that sort of marriage of what did the two of you put into the business? I was struck by him being a sculptor because I was thinking of the sort of shapes of dresses and things.
So he was at Central, Matthew, doing sculpture. And then what happened is he left and he became an art director for Pop Videos. We'd known each other at college, but then he asked me to make some costumes for some of the videos. And then we sort of got together. I think more than anything, we wanted a creative life together, both very sort of creative. And we actually got our studio in Portobello without knowing actually what we were going to do in it. It's just like, let's get a space and do something. I think working with another creative person has been very good for a fashion business, because I think a lot of the time you have the designer that's very creative, and then you perhaps have the CEO that's doesn't understand creativity.
Yeah. But it sounds like you were very artistic and slightly bohemian. And so was setting out to make bridal wear quite a sort of an incongruous
choice? Oh, that didn't come
until
much later, the bridal wear. We started off with the evening wear collection. I'm trying to think how long we've sold to Harrods. I've quite a funny story with me and Harrods. I think it might have been up here somewhere. There was a big office with lots of women in it. And they made me try the dresses on in front of them all with my DMs and everything. So I sort of kept coming back in with these little sort of tutus in my DMs. And that's how we got into Harrods, actually.
So who inspired your sense of glamour and luxury and, you know, those sort of elements of what you do?
I don't know. I mean, I think from an early age, I was probably, you know, watching those sort of amazing Hollywood movies. And I think being in Southampton that I found very unglamorous, really. I just must have been so taken away with it. Just the idea of sort of dressing women like that, I think, must have just caught me.
I think your new collection might be slightly influenced by Jean Harlow. And we've got some amazing dresses hanging up in this little office that we're in. Two that are incredibly sequined, one silver and one gold. But I've fallen in love with this beautiful white one in the centre that's just incredibly elegant.
She was quite fascinating. And I think she was quite a sort of strong character. And I think a lot of those young actresses at that point, they were, you know, making movies like every day, and they were out every night. And you really get the feeling that they were having a lot of those sort of issues that a lot of young women have. And they were very stressed. They were the Lindsay Lohans of that time.
Yeah.
You know, she was actually dead by 26. But she belonged to a period of Hollywood called pre-code Hollywood, which I'd never heard of.
No.
So it was when the talkies began, there was about 4 or 5 years before it was called the Hayes Law. before they brought in all the laws about what you could and couldn't do in a film. So she was in this group of films which were really quite flirty and sexy, and you could see her wearing quite sort of naughty things, really, and saying really outrageous. And if you watch them, it is like, oh yeah, these really are quite lawless.
Edgy.
Lawless, yeah. And then it all changed, you know, and suddenly people had to have one foot on the floor if they had a bad scene and all of that. So if you look at her wardrobe, it was very inspiring because you would have the screen Jean, which was usually the leading ladies in the black and white movies always wore white because they had to shine more than anyone else. So you've got all of that wonderful wardrobe that she wore in the movies. But then obviously she still was a really young woman, you know, sort of same age as my daughter. And her other wardrobe is incredibly sort of playful and young and frilly. And, you know, so you've got this lovely combination. And that's what we used for that collection, really.
You've kept alive a fashion company for a long time. And that's no mean feat, particularly in the world of fashion, you know, where it's the vagaries. So what do you think is the secret of your longevity? I think you're probably a pretty hard worker.
Yeah, we work really hard, especially in the, you know, those the first years. I think both Matthew and I have a real sort of sense of not giving up. And I think in fashion, unfortunately, despite all the sort of glamour around it, is a very hard business, you know, because every season you put your collection there and, you know, do people like it or not? And, you know, it's incredibly fickle. You know, you can have loyal customers for a very long time, but unless they believe they can sell your dresses, you know, I mean, obviously the relationship will count for quite a lot, but things, you know, politically, situations change. You know, we've had the Ukraine and you build up customers and then, you know, they just have to pack up or, you know, the business isn't there. So you just have to be very fluid, actually, with the way of thinking. And I think sometimes you find that, you know, what you could sell at that price, you can't sell at the moment. So you have to adapt what you do and lower the prices and find a different way of doing things. Having a niche product, doing something that is, first of all, we can sell it internationally. And when we started, I think it was quite easy to be competitive internationally with evening wear. You know, people often sort of say, well, why haven't you gone into doing this and that and everything? You think, well, you know, let's just do this and do it really well. And then you're known for it and you can keep that business going. And I do believe that is one of the sort of strongest reasons why we're still here.
Being here at Harrods obviously introduces you, though, I'm sure that happens through your own company as well, to a very international buying market. How much do you let that influence what you design, or how much do you have to take it on board? I mean, like you mentioned there was the Ukraine and they were probably very good customers at one point, but probably aren't now. Mm. You know, you'll have clients from the Middle East, I imagine, from the Far East. How much do you have to keep that at the forefront of your creative brain as well as designing the things that you love anyway?
I really like to sell dresses, and people say, what's your favourite dress in the collection? And, you know, I'm not ashamed of it. It's the one that sells the most because that means I've done a good job with that dress. It's done what it's meant to do, which is people have liked it. One of the best things about my life is I've been able to travel to a lot of countries to meet the shops and the clients, and that is absolutely essential because you need to know where they're going in the dresses, and you need to know culturally what they can wear and what they can't wear. And you just need to see what else they're selling in that region. And, you know, you need to get into each market because each market is very different. So when I put a collection together, I'm thinking about all those different women all over the world and making sure that I've got enough dresses with sleeves and I've got short ones for the south of France. And, you know, within 35 pieces, which is usually one of our collections, there's quite a lot to cater for, you know, and then they all complain because they want this one. Could we have this one with a sleeve? Could this one be short? And you just can't supply everything, but you have to just sort of do what you can.
And is it more fun to design when there are more rules applied to what can be worn than when you have an entirely free rate?
I think a bit of both, actually. I mean, even if you say, if the, you know, the sales manager says to me, I need a dress with long sleeves and this sort of colour and with a train, I mean, even around that, there's so much you can do. It's just never ending with evening wear, the combinations of fabrics and colours and things that we can do. Then sometimes, you know, yeah, you think, okay, I'm going to do an amazing press piece, or I'm going to do something that maybe nobody will buy, but it would be real fun to make. I mean, that's why working with someone like Dieter Von Teese, you know, when she gives us a costume to do, it's such a treat for us because it's like, first of all, instead of keeping the dress on, we've got to find a way of it coming off. And, you know, all the sort of technical stuff of, you know, when there's lights on it, you know, what colour's it going to go? So we quite often have projects like that. And I think it brings a lot of creativity into the studio. And then it sort of bounces back into the collection.
It sounds to me like you love the sort of the costume, the imaginative side of it very much, the kind of showbiz side of it, if you will. And you have designed costumes for a number of films. Is that something that you really like to do, or is that harder again? Because I suppose, like being a scriptwriter or whatever, it's a cooperative effort. It's not you're not mistress of your own destiny.
Actually, I like it, and I think after 30 years, it's just really nice to go into different worlds and work with people that need different types of things. So Dieter's always a challenge. Dressing Kate Winslet when she's pregnant is another challenge. You know, how to make her feel really good about herself, because she's got to go out on a catwalk, and not catwalk, red carpet, and she's 8 months pregnant. So that's good. That's what makes the job interesting.
And what about, like, I would have thought as an evening wear designer that dressing Bond girls must be just the most absolute fun that you can have, because they have to be everything that a perfect evening dress is about, don't they?
The first one that we did for Rosamund Pike, it came off very quickly. I think it's a love scene with Bond, and it was just like, phew, and it was quite a heavy dress. And I remember sat there in the cinema and just thinking, like, oh, that was it.
Oh no, how disappointing.
So then when we did the next one, which I think wasn't the next film, or maybe one after, and it was Caterina Murano, Italian actress, and we made this dress that all kind of laced up the back so she couldn't get it off much.
You did that on purpose, didn't you? So that Bond couldn't get it off that quickly. She died in it.
She died, ended up dead in it. But I met her actually about a year ago, and it was really lovely. She came into our showroom in Paris, and she said that dress completely changed her life. Because when she walked on set, apparently everybody went quiet. And she was unknown before then, and it was just all about the dress. For us, what was extraordinary about that one was that we got men all over the world ringing us, wanting that dress. I mean, it's never happened before or after that men have rung up and ordered a dress. But I think either they were seeing themselves as a bit of a James Bond, or they just saw her and thought, oh, maybe if I get my girlfriend in that dress, she's going to look like that.
What do you do in a situation?
It's fun.
Do you make the dresses?
We made lots of those dresses, yeah. And Harrods actually sold a lot of them for us as well.
You mentioned your showroom in Paris. Mm-hmm. And I know in 2009 you started showing in terms of shows in New York rather than London. I wondered why you'd made that decision. And you know, you're a very British fashion name, but your clientele seems to be incredibly diverse.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd shown in London for quite a while. I think at the time there was very much a sort of UK style, which was very sort of quirky. And I felt I was taking our collections and styling them and doing things. And the last one, I sort of looked at it and I thought, oh, I'm just trying to sort of pander to the UK press here. So I just wanted to show beautiful, glamorous clothing on, you know, models that looked like they'd be wearing them as well. So there was a bit of that. And I also, again, I just wanted to try somewhere different. And we also wanted to expand into the American market. And I think it helped us a lot to be actually in America, meeting everyone there. And then we started working with all the stores.
Is there a big difference, do you think, then, between the American sort of fashion world and the British one? I have this sense that's completely based on nothing tangible, that you know, I always get the best shoes in America because you can actually walk in them. That's my theory anyway.
They're quite commercial, especially the big department stores. It is all about what your sell-through is, and it's viewed like that. When we went there, I think it was like, great, she does evening dresses. That's fine. You know, very clear. And that's what they wanted from us. You know, like you say, I think it is all about what they can sell. We're much more open to newness here, actually, and slightly quirky sort of style.
I mentioned in the introduction that you're known very much so, and you know, incredible names come to you for their clothing. But is it a different landscape now, because you're competing in an area where these huge companies are sort of throwing everything at people to get them to wear their clothes and so on, and you're there just doing the right thing, designing great dresses.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is. I mean, I've seen it go in sort of waves, actually, where the big companies come along and they pay people to wear things. But ultimately, what happens is, you know, the feedback we get from the stylist and the actresses that after a while, they're not given that much choice, and you know, maybe they don't want to wear that, so they come out of it, and then they're looking for something you know, they're more open to different designers again. And I think we're sort of coming out of that wave again now. You know, ultimately, if you put a good dress in front of someone, they'll choose it. You know, when we get something on, you know, on the red carpet, there's usually they've got a whole load of choices, and it's incredibly fortunate if they choose one. But I don't know, I think the whole fashion landscape's changing a lot at the moment, because you've got the big designers, but there's also a lot of new companies coming through where I think the sort of attitude is that you don't have to know who's behind the company. I mean, I think coming through the 80s and the 90s, it was all about who the designer is, and, you know, that would be the brand, and people are buying into the brand. But now, especially sort of young people, not so bothered with all that. They're much more open to, like, is it good? They want the integrity, but they don't need to know who's sort of behind it all. For me, number one is I love my work. I've never tried to be famous. I've tried to think, let me do the best I can. And then if I get somewhere with that, and if I dress some interesting people, then that's fab.
When you're designing and you know, making these incredible dresses, how much are you sort of seduced by the luxury elements of them? I mean, are you one of those people who has women sewing on sequins one by one? And, you know, how much into that realm do you go?
I think what I'd make is incredibly luxurious, you know, because basically I can do anything I want on that dress. And I work with amazing factories that can do so much. If you're interested in an evening where you can do anything you want, embroideries, prints, I think for me, that has been a real luxury. And I think, you know, pricing your collection at a certain level where you can play with all those different things. And you've still got to be very conscious of price because, you know, the customer is. But I think there's always so much scope there. And that, to me, has been very luxurious.
What's your favourite thing about your job?
I've never lost the love of just sitting down and drawing and coming up with something new. It's always that sort of, I'm going to do better this time. And every season, there's a couple of days after you've done the collection or you've done the sales where you think, oh, I hate this. I'm never going to do another collection. And then it's like 2 days and you're just sort of like, something just sparks your attention, or you see something and you think, oh, I could turn that into a dress. So I love that. I love the travel a lot, actually. I love traveling. You know, that's been very sort of inspirational. And actually, I've really loved the people I've worked with. I think I've had amazing teams of people over the years. And I think it's one of those jobs where everyone is generally really passionate about it. And they moan about staying late, but actually that's what they really want to do. You know, we all want to be sat there sort of making things at about midnight.
Over a glass of wine.
For someone who's not going to wear it.
Is there someone that you'd still love to dress?
I have got somebody I'd like to dress, but I don't think she's the Jenny Packham person at all. And I think maybe that's why I'd quite like to dress her, is Tilda Swinton. I mean, love her as an actress and everything. But I just know she's really not a Jenny Packham girl yet. But we did a wonderful collection a few years ago called 31 Women, and it was based around Peggy Guggenheim, that had an exhibition of 31 women artists in about 1940 something. So I thought, okay, I'm going to put together 31 women, and we picked anyone we liked, dead or alive. And it was really fun, actually, because we looked into all of them. I mean, we had people like Elizabeth Taylor and Emily Blunt and Marilyn and Peggy. And then we sort of really looked into their wardrobes and what they would really want from an evening dress. That was a sort of lovely thing. So I think having Tilda there, maybe she's not going to wear anything, but maybe it pushes me to be a little bit more edgy.
We've talked about luxury in terms of the things you make and everything. I wondered, I think you've brought me along something that you consider to be a luxury.
Yeah, this is really special, actually. So it's a photograph of it. I don't actually own it, but I was very, very fortunate to see it. We did a collection on Marilyn Monroe. It was quite a journey, actually, the whole sort of collection. What happened was I saw a postcard of Marilyn in Paris, and I just thought, why are you still here? You know, you died so long ago and you're everywhere. And then I made a little game up of seeing whether I could spot her every day. And you can see Marilyn every day if you want somewhere. You know, in the gallery, I walked down the road in Paris and there was a bust of Marilyn in one art gallery window. On the other side, there was Goyard and they had all her suitcases. And then it became a bit of a fixation for a while. And then it's like, what is so special about this woman? So decided to do a collection about it, and sort of it was a sort of journey of discovery of why, you know, she's there, because she's there so much that you almost look at her and don't even notice her. Mm. Yeah. So we went to LA and we stayed at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and I was with a colleague and we were sort of wandering around the gardens and bumped into the security guard, and he thought, oh, he's going to chuck us out. And he said, do you want to see Marilyn's bungalow? You know, so we were like, oh yeah, okay, that fits in quite nicely.
Oh wow.
So we did that, which was amazing. And then when we came back, one of my colleagues was living in Jersey, and a contact of hers knew this amazing guy called David Gainsborough Roberts. And he lived in Jersey, and he had a lot of Marilyn's dresses, apparently. So we went round to his house one morning, which was also full of the most amazing things, like Lord Lucan's robes. And he was just a collector of very, sometimes quite macabre things, actually. And he pulled boxes from underneath this bed, and in them were the Some Like It Hot dress. This photograph is a photo of the inside of Marilyn's bus stop corset that she wore.
And I mean, you said some of the things this man collected were macabre. The photograph looks quite macabre in a way, doesn't it?
This was my photograph, and I can't even tell you what the outside looked like. I was just went straight into the inside. And for me, that was absolute luxury to go in, because even when you go to a museum and you see dresses on stands, you never see the insides. You just see the outside. And in a
this
way,
is like the skeleton, isn't it?
Yeah, and also because most of them were performance pieces, you know, when she was sort of in the movie, they were kind of like, you could see where like halfway through they'd thought, let's make it a bit tighter here. And there was like really, they were quite rough actually inside. You know, there were other pieces where she really had put sort of buttons for nipples. And this is before Lycra, you know, so all of this in here, what we're looking at is this sort of the inside of the corset with some cups, but there's loads of sort of strapping inside, band.
It looks almost surgical, to be honest.
Stomach down. Yeah, they would just be tweaking it all day, and you could very much read that inside the garments. So for me, this was really luxurious day of going in and seeing something that was so special, really, you know, to see the inside of her garments and all the tricks that they were doing to make her look like, you know, she did. And I think she knew a lot of tricks as well. And I think we all very much think of Marilyn wearing, you know, in black and white, actually. And I think a lot of her very sort of iconic images are in black and white. But she used, once, you know, we had colour photography, she used colour really, really well, really punchy and quite repetitive wardrobe, actually. She wore a lot of the same things, you know, like Angela Merkel. You know, like she had
I
lots of...
I can't believe you're talking about Marilyn and Angela Merkel in the same sense.
But they, you know, just sort of finding shapes that worked and then, you know, wearing them in lots of different colours.
And just finally, if I was to let you run rampant through Harrods now on your way out, where do you think I'd find you?
Well, first of all, I'd run off to find the pet department, but it's not there anymore. You know, when I was young, there was always these stories that you could buy a horse from Harrods or an elephant or something.
Lion.
Yeah. So, I mean, in one way, I'm pleased it's gone because, you know, it's not good to have, you know, little animals in cages. But we used to come here with Chris and it would be like a family memory of going and having a look at all the animals because it was Harrods. But that's not there. So then I would go down to the perfume department. I love perfumes. I've met some perfumers and I've, you know, have no sort of knowledge at all, but I love that world.
Are you tempted to make one?
I would love to make one, actually, but I think, I don't know, the time will come.
What would it smell like?
What would it smell like? Well, it would be very glamorous, rich, with, I don't know, a bit of a light side.
Thank you very, very much indeed, Jenny Fackham.
Thank you.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Jenny Packham. Next week, I meet the chef who's put Indian cuisine firmly onto the luxury map, the twice Michelin-starred Vineet Bhatia. This series is recorded in Harrods in London. Thank you to our sponsor, Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.